Now here I want to point out something which I think has not been noticed before. And this, in fact, is what I'm really getting at. The same word is used to describe the noble quest as the ignoble quest. That is to say, the word pariyesana. Pariyesana. It's used to describe both the noble quest and the ignoble quest. And this point is really of crucial importance, both theoretically and practically. Years ago, non-Buddhists, or people who were new to Buddhism, were fond of putting a certain question. I've been asked it many a time, and perhaps you also have been asked it. And the question is this: doesn't Buddhism contradict itself when it says that desire must be eliminated? For how can desire be eliminated without the desire to eliminate it? This question is supposed to completely floor the unfortunate Buddhist. But it is in fact based on a misunderstanding, even on ignorance. It's not a question of there being one kind of desire which is trying, as it were, to commit harakiri. We may say that there are two kinds of desire with two radically different objects. There is desire, asana, for what is conditioned, that is to say, the desire for nirvana. This is represented, of course, by the anarya, there is the desire, asana, for what is conditioned, and there is the desire for nirvana. And the first, the desire for what is conditioned, is represented by the anarya pariyesana, the ignoble quest, and the other, the second, the desire for nirvana, is represented by the arya pariyesana, the noble quest. So the fact that there are two kinds of desire with two radically different objects is reflected in another pair of terms which we have. That is to say, the terms karma chanda and dhamma chanda. Chanda is a very strong term indeed. According to the PTS's Pali English Dictionary, chanda means impulse, excitement, intent, resolution, will, desire for, wish for, delight in. Karma is sensuous experience, and Dhamma is the Buddha's teaching, inasmuch as that teaching reflects truth or reality. So it's easy to see what karma chanda and dhamma chanda mean. There's also the term tanha or trishna in Sanskrit, literally thirst or drought, usually translated as craving. And this is a very strong term too. Unlike asana and chanda, it has no positive counterpart and is almost always used in an entirely negative sense. That, of course, is something into which Sagarmati enters in the book which was launched a little earlier this evening. So it's this craving, this karma chanda, this trishna, which, based on ignorance, keeps the wheel of life revolving. It's the energy, we may say, that powers the wheel of life. So, the question that arises is, what is the energy that powers the spiral? If trishna powers the round, the wheel of life, what powers the spiral? Or what powers us inasmuch as we are on the spiral, or to the degree that we are on the spiral, or as we make the transition from the round to the spiral? So what powers us is Arya Paryasana. What powers us is Dhamma Chanda. So it's not enough to eliminate tanha, craving, desire for the conditioned. We also have to cultivate what we may call the positive asana, the positive chanda. In fact, we may say it's doubtful if we can simply eliminate tanha. It's more a question of gradually replacing desire for conditioned things with desire for nirvana. But desire for conditioned things, we know only too well, is very, very powerful. Tanha or craving is very, very powerful. As I've said, it's the energy that keeps the whole process going. It's the energy that powers the wheel of life as it turns again and again. It powers every aspect of ordinary, unenlightened human existence. It powers our personal life. It powers our domestic life. It powers our social and political life, our professional life. It powers much of our cultural life. And it even powers some of our so-called religious life. So it's not easy to get away from craving, not easy to get away from Krishna. Usually we are in its grip. So we can get away from it, we can get out of its grip, only to the extent that our Arya Paryasana, our Dhamma Chanda, is stronger. And this means that our Arya Paryasana, our Dhamma Chanda, has to be very strong indeed. It has to be a powerful emotion. It has to be an act of concentrated will. Not just an idea, faintly tinged from time to time with emotion. It's no accident that the ancient Greeks spoke of the love of wisdom, philosophy. Love with us is often a very, very weak term. It would perhaps be better if we spoke of a passion for wisdom, even a craze for wisdom, love of wisdom. In English, at least, sounds very, very weak. It sounds a bit pathetic. So it's no accident that Buddhism speaks of Dhamma Chanda. Unfortunately, in the West, philosophy has become mainly a purely intellectual exercise. And similarly, Buddhism has become, in some quarters, simply a subject for academic study. Only too often, we set up an idea of the Arya Paryasana, an idea of the spiral, and then we try to grasp it by means of an intellect powered by the energy of craving. And the result very often is what I call literalism. But this is not the way. The way is to learn simply to contemplate, initially, the idea of the Arya Paryasana, the idea of the spiral. We have to learn to appreciate it in the full sense of that word. We have to learn to be moved by its beauty. We have to learn to be emotionally stirred by it. And then, when we've learned to appreciate it to some extent, when we are moved to some extent by its beauty, emotionally stirred by it, then, from deep within, there will arise at least the germ, at least the glimmering of the Arya Paryasana itself, the Dhamma Chanda itself. And this is, presumably, what happened in the case of the Buddha when he was still a bodhisattva. This is what led him to go forth. You remember that the fourth of the four sites was a sadhu, a wanderer. And the Buddha just saw him. And that decided him. The first three sites turned him away from conditioned existence. But it was the sight of the beauty, so to speak, of that fourth sight, the sadhu, in his yellow robe, this wandering that moved him to go forth in the direction of nirvana, the unconditioned. Yeah? This is what led him to go forth from home into homelessness. So his going forth, his pabbaja, to use the traditional term, was a movement away from conditioned things and towards nirvana. It was a movement made possible by a shift in the emotional center of his being. A shift that was occasioned by his seeing the four sights, whether literally or metaphorically. My own going forth, I have to admit, was occasioned by something rather less radical. The immediate occasion, of course, as was mentioned a little earlier, was my disillusionment with organized religion, as I'd so far encountered it, as represented by the Mahabuddhist Society of India and my old friend Panditji, whom some of you may remember. But no doubt, deeper forces were also at work. However that may be, I certainly did feel that I was following in the footsteps of the Buddha, even though I was far from realizing the full significance of what I was doing. And perhaps I don't realize its full significance even now, 50 years later. Though at least I'm not able to place it within a broader context. In any case, there were important differences between the Buddha's going forth and my own. Apart from the obvious ones, there was the fact that I was a Buddhist. I went forth as a Buddhist. The Buddha, of course, was not a Buddhist. Buddhism didn't exist then. Siddhartha Gautama, rather, was not a Buddhist. Well, some Indian scholars are fond of saying that he was a Hindu, but that wasn't the case either. What was he? He was, we may say, just Siddhartha Gautama, just going forth. I was a Buddhist because I'd gone for refuge before my going forth to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. The Buddha, or Buddha-to-be, had not gone for refuge to anyone. He didn't follow in anyone's footsteps. He was a pioneer